Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm driving to a podcast, a freaking Mel Brooks podcast.
Hey, it's Chris Hardwick. I am driving in my car, but safely using a microphone so that both hands are free to use the wheel. And I'm gonna go podcast Mel Brooks today, which is huge for me. I'm still trying to process that information. I'm not going to turn into a stack of Jell-O. I stack Jell-O. I'm not afraid. I'll do it. But that is very exciting news. So that'll be coming up on the Nerdist Podcast very, 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 very soon. But tomorrow, which is November 20th, we're going to put out the trailer for Neil's Puppet Dreams, Neil Patrick Harris's show, where he sleeps a lot, and when he dreams in puppet. It's a co-production with the Henson Company and Neil Patrick Harris. So the trailer for that goes up tomorrow, and Neil's Puppet Dreams starts on November 27th on the Nerdist YouTube channel, youtube.com/Nerdist. See, I'm driving, so I can't edit this. Everything stays! I would also like to thank Stamps.com as our returning sponsor to the Nerdist Podcast. It's almost the holidays, for crap's sake, and you are going to be mailing a lot of stuff because people demand that you pay them tribute on the holidays. You have to send them things. Gift cards to Chili's or wherever it is that you send your family. That's what my dad said to me one year. He was like, don't send me anything. Just send me gift cards to, like, Chili's. I'm going to eat there anyway. So now it sounds like it's turning into a Chili's ad. It's not. I don't eat there. There. I just canceled that out. How about that? One time I ordered a chicken salad off the healthy menu at a Chili's in Missouri, and I got a salad with ranch dressing and fried chicken. There. I've balanced it out now. Okay? Are you happy? Stamps.com, though, let's say you wanted to mail that salad to someone. You don't want to go wait in the post office. That salad's going to go bad by the time you get up to the window. Take it home, stuff it in an envelope, go to Stamps.com. You can weigh it with a bonus, a postage scale that they're going to send you, and then you can send that salad to someone, their delicious Christmas salad to someone. Print out the postage from any computer, and you're good to go. So before you do anything else, go to Stamps.com, click the radio microphone at the top of the page, and type in the promo code Nerdist. You're going to get a $110 bonus offer of stuff from Stamps.com, so please use it. Stamps.com, offer code Nerdist. This episode was really special to me. It honestly was. I've known Jimmy Kimmel since I started in the biz. I started in K-Rock in 1995. I had just, the Singled Out show had just aired, or was just about to air, and I got hired at K-Rock, and became pals with Jimmy then. And then we kind of drifted apart over the years, and I always felt bad about it. And I always felt like, what did I do? And I feel dumb, and, you know. And this was so nice to actually just sit down. This is the longest conversation we've had in years. And it was absolutely wonderful. Jimmy's a terrific guy, which, of course, you know if you watch the show and you see that he employs a lot of his family and a lot of his friends. And I always love that model. So Jimmy's a terrific guy, and we recorded this just a couple weeks ago in his office at the Jimmy Kimmel Studios. So here you go, the Nerdist Podcast number 2, whatever it is that I can't remember because I'm operating a vehicle right now and it would be unsafe to go online to see what number that is. Let's say 284? Huh? If I get hired, does that make it less awkward? Oh crap, there's a cop.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
You have a really great view of the high school track back there, which is...
Yeah, Hollywood High School. I look down on it. And, I mean, literally, I look down on
the public education system.
Yeah.
I'm better than you. I pulled myself up.
That's right. I'm an adult. I don't have to... Actually, I get very jealous watching them play baseball and run around on the field while I'm hunched over my computer working.
Having to, like, every day, because it's a... But
comedy is an easy job, right? I mean, all you do all day long is crack jokes. What do you have to do all day long? Oh my God, I can't imagine. Because I remember when Ferguson was on the show a couple years ago, he said it never sank into his head when he took the job. Like, no, this is something you will have to do every day. This is an everyday kind of a thing.
Well, I started in radio, so I had that everyday pressure of. Well, you remember when we were working at K-Rock and all the nonsense that went on and how I was constantly pecking away at my computer and doing stupid voices and writing scripts for Kevin and Bean and never
ended. I guess that's true. At least this way you don't have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
I don't have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they have food, which we never had at the radio station, which is nice.
For as big a station as K-Rock was in the 90s, it was... the most unglamorous setup you could possibly...
Oh, it's disgusting. And it still is, by the way. Still big and disgusting. I mean, it's really like... It was embarrassing. You'd have guests come in and they'd say, hey, can I get a cup of coffee? And we'd be like, yes, you can.
Not here.
I'm not going to get one for you because I'd have to go to a store. And we didn't have Starbucks back then, so it was like you'd have to go to the 7-Eleven.
Or wait till... Because Dalt's didn't open. There was that restaurant in the basement, in the lobby level.
And we'd eat there so early that it always smelled like cleaning products. Very appetizing.
It's such a it's almost like being in a radio station for a morning show is almost like going into a bar.
Yeah,
when it's daytime,
it's like being in a strip club in the morning.
And you should never be there. It's gross. It just like smells like breath or just like people respiring all night.
The only people there are the weirdest people who work there, like the engineer maybe, and, you know, some weird security guard that no matter how many times you come to work doesn't know who you are.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. That always happened. And then I got trained... Because I got hired to work on the morning show from just coming on the morning show.
Yeah.
And so it was very weird. And so I got hired on a Friday and started on a Monday. And I was trained by Boogerman, who was the overnight guy.
Who tried to choke you to death.
Yes.
Yeah. You were trained by, this is a homeless person. I got a job at the radio station. You realize you replaced a homeless person. They fired a homeless person to make way for you. At the radio station. And as far as I know, he's still homeless.
No, to be fair, he had a car. He
lived in a van.
Yes.
He lived in a Volkswagen van.
Yes.
And it said Boogerman all over it.
Yep.
And I think he had like Bart Simpson characters glued to the top of the van. It's one of those guys that you see around town.
He was always very nice to me, but I always sensed that like there was a breaking point, and there was a breaking point because he did try to murder you.
Yeah, he just tried to choke me, not necessarily kill me, but and I'm the one who got him the job there. And as I recall, I had nothing to do with whatever it was he tried to choke me over.
I don't even know what happened.
I'm trying to remember. I think Kevin and Bean were inquiring about his like girlfriend or something, and he started flipping out on them, and I happened to be in the studio, and I decided to be the one to kind of move him out of the studio,
right.
And then he started choking me, and it was no good.
Oh, my God.
I remember also going into the program director's office, Kevin Weatherly, afterwards, and there was a little meeting about the choking, and I was like, so what's going to happen here? And he's like, well, I don't want him to kill me. I said, all right, then I guess he stays.
Let's keep the guy. Let's send the message that this is okay behavior.
As long as you're dangerous, it's okay to choke.
You can choke anyone as long as it's not the program director. Everyone else is totally on limits. No issues. But you came from... You came from... Wait, you came to radio from Arizona, but you were from Vegas.
Yeah, I grew up in, I was born in Brooklyn. We moved to Vegas when I was 9. I did college radio when I was in high school in Las Vegas. Then I worked in a bunch of radio stations. I mean, I worked at Phoenix, Seattle, back to Phoenix, Tampa, Tucson, and then Palm Springs, I forgot, and then Tucson, and then K-Rock in L.A.
I mean, it's funny how consistent... For people who've never been to a radio station, the types of people that work at radio stations are consistent no matter what market you're in. It's like, oh, there's that guy.
Oh, yeah.
And there's that guy. And the engineer's crazy. And then
it's like a sitcom.
It really is.
You got the crazy engineer who, when something's wrong, thinks you broke it or don't understand how to use it, even though you've been using it every day for years with no problem. You've got the program director who's probably too old to be programming a top 40 radio station and who's going to be in Tucson for the rest of his life if he's lucky. You've got the newswoman who was at one time attractive and maybe had something going on with the general manager. Then there's a general manager who might be someone important's son,
sure,
who might have a flask in his desk, and the afternoon guy who wants your job. And
it's surprisingly consistent. Everyone's headshot is like 15 years old,
yes,
like 15 years younger than where
stonewashed.
And then you actually see them at live events. You're like, what the fuck happened?
But when I worked in Phoenix, I worked at a radio station. I didn't work there. I didn't get paid. I was just a kid who called into the radio station. And they had a morning guy who was very popular. The station was hugely popular. I mean, hugely popular. So they had a morning guy named Bruce Kelly, and he had a sidekick named Maggie Brock. And there was a big concert, and they came out, and the whole audience cheered when they saw them. And then the midday woman came out, and the whole audience cheered. And then the afternoon guys, Mike and Kent, and the whole audience cheered. And then they brought out the night guy, who was just hugely fat. I mean, like 500 pounds fat. Like so fat, the Domino's pizza guy, and I know this sounds like a joke, cried on his last day on the air. The Domino's pizza delivery guy came with a plaque for him and then wept. And when this guy, his name is Clark Ingram, walked out on the stage, the whole audience gasped simultaneously. Because you hear somebody's voice, and in those days, you don't go on the web and look them up, but... And then he just came out and he looked, my friend Kent said he was wearing a blue jumpsuit. He looked like the sky with feet. And that's kind of the magic of radio, is because these people look, whatever you have in your head, that's what they look like.
But not so much anymore. And we were around for that whole revolution. Kevin and Bean, by the way, I really like them a lot. A lot of the morning show guys, you go around the country and you do these radio tours. A lot of the morning show guys, you sort of feel they're a little angry.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of, you know, because radio is still a viable medium, but it's a little more unstable than it used to be.
It's not, there's no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow anymore. It's just you're there and you don't know how long you're going to be there.
Just whiling. It's like a prison set. You're just whiling away the time.
It really is true. Maybe it's just our perspective, but I'm so glad I'm not in radio anymore. I mean, I think about it at least once a week. I think, thank God I got out of radio, because it's dying. But yeah, that is true. When you call into a radio station, I have to say, it's changed a little bit for me, because on the rare occasion I do call into a radio station, they're generally kind of happy that I called, so they're on their best behavior.
Sure.
But I remember many days during the Man Show and Crank Anchors and stuff where they're kind of like, they have an extra something against you because you got over the wall.
You made it.
You know?
And you didn't take them where they want you to take them.
Yeah, you didn't throw the rope over and pull them with you. And also people kind of like, I think people, a lot of disc jockeys decided, Howard Stern says whatever he wants.
Right.
And I'm going to do that. But they didn't have the kind of the paying their dues part leading up to that.
Or the sort of brilliance. I mean, like, it's Howard just has a very authentic, honest, like, he's just who he is. And rather than people just being who they were, everyone just thought, like, oh, we'll just bring some hookers onto the show, and then we'll say the word penis 50 times. They're like, it doesn't, it's not really.
It's everything. It's all the icing, but not the cake.
Exactly.
That honest Howard that nobody had.
And the icing is very bitter.
Yeah, the icing is.
It's not a sweet icing.
It's made of arsenic.
It burns. It burns your throat, and you tear up when you even smell it. You were at K-Rock, and then I got hired, and this was like 95, And
I remember you were on our show, and our program director heard you and liked you, and he hired you. And then he did exactly to you what he did to me, which is he didn't bother to tell the guys who hosted the show that he was hiring you.
That's right.
And then it was kind of my job to figure out how you were going to fit in with the show.
And the answer was not well.
Well, I remember saying, I think maybe you should do a character or something because I know Kevin and Bean are not going to want you just sitting in there talking with them
right,
all the time.
Right, right.
Because there's already two of them.
Who can blame them? There was nothing wrong with that. And I remember after about a month of showing up, Bean said to me when I came in, he's like, still showing up, huh? And it was just like,
the first day I was there, I walked in, and I swear to God, this is absolutely true. I walked in the studio, and they said, they hired you? I'd moved out here from Tucson. I packed everything I owned and my family and moved out here.
We're doing it, guys. Babies. We're doing it.
And they said, they hired you? And I said, oh, no. Oh, this shit. Is very, very bad.
Yeah. So, and since then, let me just say, you know, I've become very good friends with those guys. And, you know, yeah. Bean, we talk very, you know.
They're great guys, but it didn't make sense really to hire guys. Somebody to.
I don't blame them at all. Yeah. But how do you.
I'm glad you got rid of those other two guys.
Jonas. They're still on the. Okay. They're both working today. By the way, they were super bummed. Matt's still working. Attack of the Show is in its death throes, and Matt is kind of finishing up another month there, and Jonah had to work today. But Jonah was particularly bummed that he couldn't come because he, you know, Jonah is sort of a renowned freeloader. Uh-huh. And so when you started your show about 10 years ago, the idea that there was food and drinks here in the green room was legendary. And so it was a comedian nest.
I remember the first time, I think one of the first times I met Jonah, I saw him do stand-up comedy. And then the next time I met him, he was at the Arclight Theaters telling people to turn off their phones.
He was working at the Arclight for a while. Yeah, he worked at the Arclight.
And I remember thinking, well, this is weird. And I thought, well, maybe he's just doing this to fuck around. Like, he's not really working with the theater and he's just fucking around. But then it turned out he wasn't.
He was actually working there, yeah. So, you know, I know Jonah had so many great experiences and stories here, but he just ended up having a work today.
I'll mail him some beer.
Would you send him a beer or something? So when I did not fare well on the Kevin and Bean show because at a certain point I kind of just stopped showing up, and so that was a perfect excuse for them to be like, he's not even showing up. And then Kevin was like, we're going to move you. Weatherly said, we'll move you back to overnight. So I went back to the overnight show, the midnight to five shift, which, you know, it was fine. So my point is, I did not navigate those waters well, and you managed to figure out how to slip in and adapt to the program.
Well, you have to understand, like, this is your introduction to radio, is working at K-Rock, which is like the best radio station in the United States. Even doing the overnight shift was like a dream for
most
guys.
It was pretty crazy. If I had tried to work in radio, I never would have gotten the job. It was just a weird accident the way that it happened.
And for me, I've been in much, much, much worse situations. So I knew I had to make it work. And I remember I showed up the first day, and Kevin and Bean are both wearing shorts. And I thought, I'd read somewhere that, like, if you wanted to fit in with people, you should dress like them. So I wore shorts the next day to work. And the program director, Kevin, saw me and he goes, oh, no. What are you doing? It's like, well, I'm wearing shorts. They wear shorts. I'm wearing shorts too. He's like, he felt like he'd lost another one.
Oh, that's really funny. Is Kevin still there, right?
Yeah, Kevin's there.
Holy shit. That was a really fun time to be at K-Rock because K-Rock was really directing pop music at the time. And so we really, it was a pretty sweet gig. Like, we got to go to shows and meet people.
Adam Carolla just started as, you know, he's my boxing coach.
We started within like the same couple months. Tell the story about Adam.
Yeah, Adam was, I started at the radio. I got the job from working in Tucson, and I knew the program director, and I finally talked him into hiring me. And just as I was being fired in Tucson. And I got out there, and then Adam was a local boxing instructor. And I was fighting this guy who was on the show, this guy Michael, the maintenance man.
We had one of the boxing match.
And Adam called and volunteered to train me to box. And actually, he wanted Michael, but I happened to be the one that answered the door when he came to the back door. And so he trained me, and we became friendly. And I think we were there for about, I remember Jenny McCarthy was on the show promoting her Playboy magazine.
Right.
And our former program director had gone on to program MTV, and Bean called
Andy,
them.
Andy Schoen. Schoen, yes.
And so he heard her on the radio and wound up hiring her to do Singled Out with you.
Yeah.
And then the two of you came back to the radio station as guests.
Yeah.
And that's how
that all worked out. So with Adam, he just showed up and offered to train you, and it turns out he has this, you know, this rich background in sketch and improv and was actually a funny guy.
He showed me a public access show that he did. I'd never seen a public access show that was intentionally funny before.
Yeah.
And I remember being kind of bummed that he was going to make me sit down and watch this VHS tape of himself. I thought, there's no way this is going to be good. And I couldn't believe how good it was.
Yeah, because he's a boxing instructor. He's like a construction worker. Like,
yeah, a contractor. Yeah, yeah. He's a carpenter and... So we came up with this shop teacher character, Mr. Burcham, and he would pretend to be a teacher calling in to give messages to his students because they listened to the radio station.
Yeah.
So it you know, became a thing, and then he went on to host Loveline and left me behind at the morning show.
But then you went on, because I remember when you, like, the idea of crossing over from radio to television was pretty revolutionary. It just wasn't something that happened a whole lot.
Yeah.
And then I think you went to Ben Stein from the station, right?
I did, yeah, the Win Ben Stein's Money. I think the only reason that there was crossover to television is because we happened to be in L.A.
Right.
I think if we were in San Francisco, none of these things would have happened. Carson Daly worked at the station also.
Yep.
And, yeah, and we all wound up on TV, but it was just because people would listen to K-Rock, and then when they were auditioning or whatever, they'd say, yeah, call that guy, and, you know, we were kind of in their heads on the way to work.
But it's interesting, because we've had this, I had a conversation with you a long time, and I don't know if you know this, but I'm being totally sincere when I say this, that you were one of a role models for me, because we talked about it right after Ben Stein, and things started to get going, and you had the Man Show, and Crank Anchors, all this stuff was happening, and I said, what did you do? How did you do it? And you go, honestly, I locked myself in a room and I wrote down 100 ideas and I just, you know, I just work all the time. And so between guys like you and guys like, you know, Rob Zombie, who you just go, oh yeah, I guess if you really do devote the majority of your energy to a thing, then that will reap rewards at some point.
But it makes me sound better, I think, than the truth. The truth is I was in there hiding from my ex-wife. That's why I was in my room writing all the time. It wasn't some incredible work ethic. It was just me trying to get away.
You can masturbate, what, 1-2 times
exactly.
In an afternoon? then the rest of the time you have to do something else with your hands.
I did, and I probably shouldn't tell the story, but one time I was, we were doing the Man Show, and we had, like, some naked girls and something. And, you know, it's, I take it for granted now, but you don't typically meet, well, I don't, you do, I know, but you don't meet girls and then see them naked, you know, and, like, so, especially in the workplace.
Yeah.
So we shot a bit, and some girl was in the bathtub, and I think she was, like, a porn star, but we had her act, whatever, and she was naked. I remember thinking, this is just so great. You know, you meet her in her clothes and you cast her and then she's naked and then, you know, whatever. So I was watching some rough cut of some bit and there was a lot of footage and this girl's like naked through the whole thing and I'm in my office and I think, oh, I think I'll masturbate.
It's so genuine. I think I'm going to just do it.
But the great part is Adam is also in this bit. So my wife walks into the room. At the moment, Adam is on screen, and she comes in and goes, he goes, are you masturbating to Adam? I said, no, he just came on and just switched.
I swear to God.
I got my dick in my head. I'm trying to explain.
And he won't leave this. He was not here a minute ago. This just happened.
Oh, it was really embarrassing, but fortunately, she told everyone about it, so I don't feel bad about telling it now. I know it was very, very, very embarrassing.
That is almost like a Three's Company level of sitcom misunderstanding that I'd never think actually happens in real life.
It doesn't. It only happens to me.
I know you guys spend a lot of time together, but I didn't realize it. Like, you know, don't you think I could do better than Adam if that's really what I was into?
Well, she knew there was a love affair there, and you know, she didn't want to get in the way of it.
Adam's really funny. I feel like maybe... I don't know, five years ago or so, we had lunch, and he was working on your house and he was building you an office or something. And
oh, that was a long that was longer than
that.
Was
longer than that ago?
Yeah.
But I loved his logic. He goes, yeah, you know, I'm probably spending about 30 grand to build Jimmy an office, but he's probably going to make me about $1.5 million in the next year, so I figure it's a good investment. he's just building you this really nice office.
He did. But the one thing he didn't do is add any insulation. So when he'd open like one of the cabinets, you see these nice cabinets, but if you opened a cabinet, the earth is like dirt is behind the cabinet door. And which I thought, all right, well, I just won't open the door. But I realized that mold was growing behind that door.
Oh, gotcha.
And so we moved is basically what we did. But
and then you sued Adam and got the $1.5 million back. Okay. But I always liked the idea that, because, you know, obviously you drive your show, but it's definitely, it's not just that you have an ensemble cast on the show, but there's your life is sort of an ensemble cast of people that sort of recur.
Yeah, I try to use that. You know, I think that's something I learned from Howard Stern, using the people around, using the people at work on the show. And then for me, my family members, I thought, you know, I just really thought, how am I going to make this show different from every other talk show?
Yeah.
I have a band, I have a desk, I have an audience, we tell topical monologue jokes. And for me, I said, you know, maybe if I had my family as part of the show, that would be a funny thing.
Yeah.
And it did. It turned out, it worked out well.
Because your monologue doesn't really feel like a traditional monologue, which I think is good.
Well, we have a lot of taped pieces in it to mix it up, because otherwise I just feel like it's, I don't know, it just feels like you're reading a series of jokes off index cards.
Yeah.
Otherwise.
That have like a 50-50 shot of connecting.
Yeah.
And then it's like, and then the tone of your show is set right there, right at the top. It's
yeah.
Like, oh,
yeah.
These jokes.
And also just mixing it up helps, you know, like if you're going to do 20 jokes in a row, if you're lucky, 14 of them will work well. But
yeah.
If you do two jokes and then show some tape comedy bit you come up with, and then do two more and show a clip of something stupid that happened, and I think it just helps to throw the balance off.
Well, not only that, but let's be honest, people today do not like to just listen to words. And like, they need to see things, they need images, they need to be distracted constantly. So I think it's really important that
it definitely helps, yeah, because sitting there and watching a guy at probably half volume in the middle of the night just standing there talking about these politicians you don't give a shit about anymore can get old.
Was it ever, I guess now you and Adam have been friends for almost 20 years.
Yeah, since 94, yeah.
Was it ever, because you guys ostensibly do the same kind of thing, was there ever any kind of weirdness? You're like, I got this show!
You know what? I have to say, we're very unusual in that way. I mean, I'd been in radio for a long time when I got to K-Rock. I'd been doing radio since high school, really, and professionally since I was in college. And he shot right past me when we were on the radio. And I was the morning show sports guy. And he came on and he did this character. And it was, Mr. Burch was very, very popular. And then he got love on. He got his own show, which was like, it was kind of shocking to me. I was like, holy shit, this guy really, he flew right by me.
Yeah.
And I did feel like a little weird, but I never felt weird towards him. Really what I learned, I think, from that is, I was always a big team player, but I think I felt like at that point you really have to make sure that you take some of these laughs for yourself rather
sure.
than spreading it around so much. And you just kind of have to do that if you want to succeed as an individual performer. And so I did do that. I started focusing a little more on my sports cast and a little bit less on the show overall. And that's when I got offered Win Ben Stein's Money and Fox Football and, you know, wound up doing Crank Anchors and all these other shows.
It's a good lesson, especially because in this business, well, I guess in any field, there will always be people ahead of you. There will always be people moving past you. And you can't, you know, if you do anything with it, try to be motivated by it and not like, I'm bitter now.
Right.
'Cause fuck that guy. You know, like there's enough room for everyone to get their chance.
It is hard to do, but
it's very hard to do. Yeah.
It's a lot easier to do when you're doing well, you know? So I don't know. Maybe I would be horribly bitter and
I'm not saying I'm good at it. I just said it's a good thing to do. I mean, like, you know, you would see, especially in the stand-up community. I mean, you know, it's sort of like a lottery. Like, someone can just get a part in a thing, and it's like, phew, and there they are. And you're like, God, They just started open micing. What the fuck? You know, it's hard not to.
Stand up is the word. Yeah, there's not a people are not rooting for you in stand up comedy. I think like with Sarah Silverman, I think it was one of the first things that attracted me to her was she was genuinely happy for her fellow stand up comics who when they did well, and I was like, wow, that's. That's yeah. I thought maybe I get the real story. Hey, like you know, pretending, but genuinely happy for these people and helpful to them. And you just don't see that very much in stand up.
No, not as well. I feel like you see it a lot in the LA stand up community. And I guess it's I don't know why, but
I think things have changed or
maybe
something.
Maybe they have because I think that sort of UCB environment has been. I've found it to be pretty supportive. Everyone's really nice, but. You know, you're still a human being. It's like if sometimes if you're down on your luck and then someone shoots past you, you still can't help but go, ah, that could have been...
Yeah.
But it is, I think it's important to sit down and really focus. Did you really have a... How long did it take before you had a sense of who you were? Was that just all the radio training that by the time you got to
tell
them?
As a gay
man? As a gay man who has his office looking at a football practice.
At young boys running on a field.
Young, strapping, sweaty, throbbing males.
You know, that's a very good question, Chris. And I say it because it's about me.
Yes.
because I typically would play a character on the radio. When I was on with Kevin and Bean, I was Jimmy the sports guy. And yeah. I did a bunch of character voices. And then when I was on Winbenstein's Money, I think that was probably the first time I was myself on television. Even The Man Show was a character, really. You know, it was
right.
kind of a... You know, I'm not like that. You know,
right.
it's just, it was, but it, that was the show, and it's definitely a part of me, you know, but we were focused on a specific audience and on specific stupid things.
Right.
And so I think this show really is, you know, for even this show, you know, it takes you, you're pretending to be a talk show host. I mean, you know, even though you are a talk show host, you still, you go through a period. Like, I'm wearing a suit. Like, I never wear a suit. I'm in a costume, essentially. I'm sitting on a piece of wood with a desk that I don't actually use. I've got a desk for no reason. This desk.
Just to lean on.
It's not
just a leaning post.
To write on. It's just, yeah.
The old-timey microphones, they don't do anything.
It's there to keep my legs away from, invisible to the audience. And, so I think you go through a lot of that before you finally just forget about all of it and just talk.
It's hard. I mean, I would imagine. I think a late night show would probably be the hardest job in television because you, no matter what happens, you have to show up to work every day, and because you know there are a lot of other shows. It's like, okay, I'm a white guy. There are other white guys. What? How am I different? You know,
yeah.
Like what is it? What is it about me? And I guess. The thing that was good is that I felt like you really got a chance to develop the show and explore, and it seemed like they gave you, you know, they gave you the time that you needed to figure that out to make the show really solid.
Yeah, they did. I'm still not sure why they did. I think it was part of it was everyone liked me, I think, and I think another part of it was they had bigger fish to fry, and you know they kind of weren't focused on us at all.
Yeah,
and probably still aren't. You know, I mean, you know, the people. I don't get notes from the network. Nobody's really watching. It's just kind of we're on, and there are certain times of the year that they pay attention. Sometimes we'll have a big show, and sometimes you know I'll host something or whatever, and then everybody has a comment. But otherwise, we just kind of we're really left to ourselves for the most part.
Yeah, I think the late night slots really, because I think it's a difficult slot for them to have to reconfigure. And so I feel like late night slots tend to get a little bit more of a chance because they're like, we invested money in the show. It's a daily show. Let's let it go. Because you were filling Politically Incorrect space, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And a half hour in after that because that was a half hour long, that show.
Right.
But also, we, you know, the thing that probably saved us is we did have pretty decent ratings from the get-go, and
yeah.
It's not like they were losing money, so it wasn't a huge leap of faith to keep us
right.
on the air.
But how long did you have the job before you felt like, okay, I think we're okay, rather than each week going, maybe we'll be back next week, I don't know.
Well, I didn't even really think like that. I thought, there were many times where I just hoped the show would get canceled. I wanted the show to get canceled, because if the network canceled the show... it wouldn't be my fault. I wouldn't have to explain to my staff, like, you know, I wouldn't have to go, well, I just can't do this anymore. It's right. too much. I'm sorry you all lose your jobs. So secretly, I was dying. I was exhausted. We're doing the show live. It was five nights a week at that time. I had no idea what I was doing. I had no signature bits to rely on once a week. I had no guests many nights. I mean, every night was a mad scramble, and a lot of the pressure was put on me to find the guests.
Yeah.
And I just, like, I mean, it was. I was in a windowless office in the basement. I felt like a plant that was dying. It just was not having any fun at all. I mean, it was really just a grind in every sense of the word. And I think you could kind of see it, too, if you watch. I never look back at those shows. I mean, first of all, I'm just a mess. My suits don't fit. My sideburns are down to my neck. And it's just so painful to look back at.
Well, listen, fortunately, there's a permanent visual record of that whole period of time.
That's one of the great things. Get your home movies are available to everyone
forever.
Yeah,
but was it around? Because then you guys started to hit on something with was it around the Matt Damon video?
I think that was a big turning point for us. That was the first time we had something that everyone was talking about, and that I think, you know, that I don't know how, I still don't know how many millions of views that got, because it was before we had a YouTube channel.
Yeah,
and I remember at one time it was up to like 40 million views.
Jesus.
Just one posting alone, many people had posted it, and that's just YouTube, you know, not doesn't count Hulu or ABC.com or any of that stuff. And that's when I think celebrities kind of noticed the show and said, oh, yeah, that might be, you know, I could be funny. I could be a part of that. And, and then, of course, the Ben Affleck video was, you know, like We Are the World. It was a big deal, and we had people calling, asking to be a part of it, and you know, just kind of everything you could ask for. Although there was a little bit of a backlash from the whole thing, because after that, after those videos, every celebrity who was on the show wanted to do a huge viral video.
Oh, and it's sure,
like,
sure.
It's like, you have to explain everybody. It's like, we don't have just like a trunk full of those ideas. They, you know, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. You know, sometimes they're big, sometimes
they're
not.
No, you'll just make a viral video, and you make it, and then 50 million views, right?
I can't tell you how many times they're like, yeah, they want to make a viral video. Like, we're doing a television show here.
You might as well say this, because now, like, when you... If you ever get a breakdown of what all the networks are looking for programming wise, it's always funny. They go, "We're looking for the next big thing." You're like, when would you not be? So why don't you just say you want $1 billion? I want $1 billion.
Just boil it right there.
Yeah, exactly. That's essentially what they're saying. And you can't. It's you know, you can sort of. I mean, having been building this YouTube channel, you can approximate. You go, well, you know, if this has this element, more people might be inclined to share. But you never have any idea what people are really going to go after.
When I was on the radio, I would frequently, the listeners would send me these casting breakdowns, and they would say, looking for a Jimmy the Sports Guy type. And I was never contacted for any of the jobs. I am Jimmy the Sports Guy.
No, we said type. not him.
Really, like, a weird thing. There's this strange disconnect. I mean, it makes perfect sense if you're looking for a Jimmy the Sports Guy type to call him.
No.
No.
No, we just want the type.
Let's run an ad looking for the type.
Yeah. And then, Jimmy, could you come in and help us coach some of these Jimmy the Sports Guy types we want
I've been in that kind of a situation.
You know what that is? That's entertainment business friend zone. That's what that is.
Yeah.
You're in the friend zone. You're not going to get the job. They're just aware of you, and you're pleasant, but you're not going to be the one that actually
gets it. I'm convinced that there is a department that works at every network that their only job is to have meetings with performers to satisfy their managers. Like, they don't greenlight shows. Nope. They don't actually do anything. They just have the meetings. Because I've had so many meetings where I was like, wow, that was great. And then, you know, my manager would be like, yeah, they loved you. And I was like,
never hear from
obvious
them.
They love you. You never, ever hear from them again.
At all, yeah. There's a whole middle management thing. And I think what they do, sort of like you say, I pretend to be a talk show host. They go, well, I have to pretend to be an executive. And executives have meetings. And I can always pawn it off on the fact that there's this committee thinking, and that's why things never get pushed through. But as long as I take pitches and meetings, I don't ever have to do anything.
And maybe if I take enough meetings, they'll let me get to the level of the people who actually make the decision.
Someone will get fired, and then they'll get promoted.
And I'll have someone take my meetings for me.
And then that's right. But there is a whole level of middle management that's just like, why are you spending so much money for this whole layer when you could just go make stuff?
Well, that seems to be coming to an end with, you know, with YouTube and people being able to make things on their own.
It's still present, though.
It is now, and I think with movies it will probably always be that way. But I think, though, I think it's so interesting when you make a video and you think, oh, this is funny, and then millions of people watch it, and you go, yeah, I guess it was funny. And then sometimes you make one and it doesn't catch on the way you thought it would. And,
right.
But it's a very democratic way of determining whether people like something or not.
It really
you can't
is.
Blame it on promos. Like, you know, in showbiz, we have so many excuses. You know, it's like, well, they didn't promote it.
Right.
They put it on Friday nights.
Yeah, time slot.
They did this.
Opposite
they,
the Olympics.
Yeah, you know, all this stuff that we, all these excuses we have for everything that goes wrong. But YouTube is just like, it's on YouTube. It is or it isn't. And you can give it a push maybe at the beginning. But ultimately, if it's great, people are going to spread it around.
Your postmortem report on those videos are like, well, after a lot of research, we determined that 13-year-olds thought it sucked.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. That's
there you
what
go.
It did.
Great.
But I think you came in, you started a show exactly at the right time because you sort of got grandfathered into the digital age that we're in now. So you had enough of a footing in traditional media that you had enough of an audience to create this sort of... I mean, you guys make some really great web clips.
Well, our first show, we showed a clip of Andy Milonakis singing "The Super Bowl is Gay" over and over again. And that was a YouTube clip that, you know, when YouTube wasn't so popular. And it really... we really did get lucky. I mean, I feel like in a way, like, I think the days of talk show hosts, well, I know they are, making $30 million to host a late night talk show... are gone. I feel like I got in just in the tail end of being able to make a decent amount of money.
Right.
And that in 5 years, that will be completely gone.
Oh, yeah. Television networks now don't have the same kind of budgets anymore like you used to. And when you worked for a while, the way that it used to work was very much like a traditional business. You would have a quote, and then you would go work on another job, and then they would meet that or raise that quote. And now the whole idea of quotes is they go, well, this is what we have.
This is it.
Do it or don't do it.
Yeah.
And it's just not the same anymore.
I guess it makes sense. It makes more sense that way in a way. And I think it opens up more opportunities for more people.
Yeah.
Which I feel like if I was 10 years older, there's no way I'd be on television. I just don't think I would. I'm, you know, when I got hired on Win Ben Stein's Money, Comedy Central was a nothing network. I mean, it was really... nobody watched it. South Park and Win Ben Stein's Money premiered the same week.
Oh, wow.
And they had no hit shows on Comedy Central.
There's a lot of Kids in the Hall reruns.
Yeah, a lot of that.
When Whose Line? Whose Line is it anyway? The British Whose Line.
Oh, yeah. I think that came on after us even. And at that time, I remember when they were selling the show, and this company that made the show, the last place they wanted to sell it to was Comedy Central. They said, worst comes to worst, Comedy Central is interested in the show. And I remember thinking, well, that doesn't sound so terrible. That would be kind of a fun place to do the show. But they were hoping to get it on, you know, in syndication or on some big network or something. But, you know, I was a kind of small player on a small show and on a small cable network. And I not had that opportunity, I don't think, you know, there's no way if I would have been on a sitcom or something. I mean,
right.
It just wouldn't have happened.
It's so funny. I always thought I wanted to... when I was younger, I always thought, like, oh, a sitcom, that's what I want to do. It's either SNL or a sitcom. That's the perfect scenario. And now I think about it, and I'm like, I don't know if I'd want to be stuck on a sitcom, because a lot of them are not great.
Yeah.
And you really can't do anything else. And, you know, it just sort of... I don't know.
It would have to be a good one.
If it's a good one,
it's great, you know.
But it's so hard to... so many things have to happen for something to be good.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are accidental. It's sort of like you said, like, well, no one paid attention to our show, so we were able to sort of sneak through. You just have to you have to slip through the cracks somehow to have the show, you know, become what it's going to be.
For sure. And I also think the other thing that I always realize is no one was going to do anything for me, that I had to come up with material for myself. I had to come up with ideas for myself, you know, and that I had to write something for myself
yeah.
if I wanted to be on, because, you know, I went to auditions as an actor. You know, even though I wasn't an actor, my agent was like, you should go to this and that. And I wasn't good at it. I didn't know how to do it. And it just felt stupid to me pretending to be playing a scene out with, you know, some lady in a folding chair. And it just all seemed ridiculous to me. And I knew that if I wanted to do anything on television, I was going to have to write it for myself.
Yeah.
And so, but now, I mean, you could do that in a half an hour. You could put something up on the...
That was very kind of internet culture on your part. Before that was really a possibility, because this was like mid to late 90s. And so it's not like the internet was really, you know.
I started with like being interested in doing little things for public access television, you know, and I was a part of Don Barris, our warm-up guy at the show. He had a public access show. I would go and do that, and that eventually became Windy City Heat, the movie we made. And so those little things I always got a kick out of, you know, just little local TV things that no one really saw, but it was just fun to make a TV show.
That's right. I hadn't seen you for a long time, and then I ran into you at the Comedy Store. Because Don was doing the thing with the guy from Windy City.
Oh, with Perry, yeah.
With Perry, where... This was the fucking weirdest thing.
Yeah.
Where it was like years ago, Perry was...
It was the 20-year anniversary of Perry being molested by a casting director. Now, Perry is probably 52 now, and there was a casting director that took advantage of him, and Don had a big party. People flew in from... Not just all over the country, but from all over the world. Because they listened to Don's podcast, the Big Three podcast.
Yep.
And they had a big celebration of the hand job Perry had to give a casting director.
Because this casting director basically said, you know, give me this hand job or you'll never work again.
Yes.
And so, you know, and his justification was like, I'm not gay. I just, you know, I was just doing it.
His big thing is he blew me. Yeah, I didn't blow him.
and they brought the picture of the guy.
I printed those up. Yeah.
How much does Perry? How aware is he?
Of what?
Of everything. Like, does he know, and is he kind of playing it, or
No.
He really doesn't know, he really doesn't understand.
I mean, he understands that people are, he just doesn't understand why people are interested in it. All he cares about is they get to make a movie, and they get to do a podcast.
That's what's so funny, is it, like, the genius of that movie, and just the whole concept of Perry is, by all rights, he's a guy that you should feel bad for, and everyone should be mad at you guys for doing what you did to him.
Yeah.
And then almost every time he opens his mouth, you're like, God damn it, he's such a dick.
That's the magic of Perry. But the truth is, he's not so different from like anybody that comes to Hollywood. He just wants to be famous. He doesn't care what the delivery method is.
Right.
He doesn't care if he's, you know, people say, I love to act. I want to act. And it's like, oh, guess what? We have a job offer for you. You can be a host on QVC. I'll take it.
Yeah,
you know,
like, he's more in the Dennis Woodruff Angeline camp.
He will do it. He just wants to be famous. Yeah,
yeah. Does he? Do you hang out with him often? Or
No. Okay. But I do have a signed skateboard from him right here.
Oh, there he is.
He says to Jimmy Kimmel, "I'm so honored to have you accept my apology last night." A lot of misspellings.
Oh, I didn't realize apology had two P's in it.
It does for
Perry. Is that a smartphone app? Apology, where you can apologize to people via smartphone?
That's a great idea. You should get on that before this podcast goes on. Delay the airing of this podcast.
Shit, until I can start apology.
Yes.
now, I guess I now owe Perry. Your Honor, he didn't know what he was saying.
I'd say that especially people that listen to your podcast, that if they've not seen Windy City Heat, they should. They should make a point. I think it's on Netflix, and you can get it on Amazon. But if people think it's fake, a lot of people think it's fake. It is not fake. Well, you know, you've seen him in action. It's 100% real.
He's so angry. Yeah. I'm not a homo. I gave him a hand job, but I didn't let him suck my dick. I'm not a homo. He just kept saying, I'm not a homo.
He's very homophobic. He's every bad thing you could imagine.
Mixed into a guy that you should really feel sorry for, but he just makes it impossible to feel sorry for.
Yeah, he does.
It's a perfect blend.
He really is.
And then you had Furman and I on your show a couple times, which was great. Tony Danza was on both of the times we came on.
Was he on both times?
Both times.
Wow.
If we were playing Danza Roulette,
That was the golden age of television. He was on both times.
Both times, Tony Danza was a guest.
Did you have any encounter with him? Did you speak to him? We just met him
backstage, and smaller guy than I would have thought. Very soft hands. Very sweet man.
Mm-hmm.
He did very soft hands. I shook his hands. I mean, you expect Tony Danza? I guess I just bought into the mythos of Tony Danza. Like, no, he's out back, like punching through boards. You know, his hands are very manicured nails, very soft. Like,
I wonder if he would take that as a compliment or as an insult that he has soft hands.
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. If we ever have him on the podcast, I'll see how he reacts. Link me in
so I can hear.
But over the years, I feel like, you know, I would run into you at various times, and there was a period of time where I thought, Jimmy doesn't like me. I don't know what it is.
Oh, really?
Jimmy doesn't like me, and I don't know what... And then we had an encounter. It was right after I gave up the booze, and you wrote me this really long email where you said, you know, the truth of the matter is I was really worried about you, and I really thought you were like...
Yeah, you were hitting it pretty hard.
But when you're doing that, you don't realize you're doing it. Oh. You just think... Oh no, I'm awesome, and everyone should think I'm awesome. And I would run into you and Sarah, and there was a little like, hey, Chris. And now, after I have like almost a decade of being on the other side of it, I go, oh yeah, when the drunk guy comes at you, you instantly your walls go up because you just don't want to engage him.
It is weird to be in that situation, and I get it a lot where I'm the not drunk guy, and then there's enthusiastic drunk guys around, and I try to be friendly, you know, but so I'm just kind of scared usually.
It's scary, and then you know, when you're not drinking, what goes through my mind now is that when people get drunk and in my face and all slobbery, even if their intentions are good, I just feel like, this conversation is fake. You're not going to remember it tomorrow.
Yeah, what's the point of this?
I'm going to end up, you know, having to shout over all the noise to tell you things you're not going to remember.
It's very fleeting.
It's so pointless.
Yeah, it's true. I guess if you're both drunk, then it kind of works out okay.
Yeah, but you both have to be at the same level.
Yeah, right.
But it's so funny. I guess I always, you know...
Now I do remember that now. Yeah,
That was sort of another thing.
You kind of became a different person because when we first met... You were not like that.
No.
And but then you start drinking a lot. And I mean, I always liked you, but I don't like to be around people who are drinking a lot.
I don't blame you. And it really was. It was a dark time, and you know, my life could have gone two completely different ways. But it really was because of, you know, guys like you and Greg Barrett and Jimmy Pardo. But that was that really meant a lot to me that you took the time, because I really felt like, oh, he actually does. It's not. I built up this whole narrative in my head.
Oh.
Like, what the fuck, you know, what, he's on television, it was like the old town, you know, buddy who was on the football team, oh, you're too big for your friends now. When really, I was the cause of it the entire time, I just had no idea, but it was very helpful to me, and I really, really appreciated that. It was very sweet.
Well, good, I'm glad, you know, stuff like that, it's, most people don't take it like that. I think that's good, but I do always feel like it's important if I don't like them, I won't say anything, whatever, just confront that kind of stuff because I feel too guilty afterwards if something bad happens and I didn't say anything.
Yeah. Well, especially because it's a very hard line to ride because you can instantly put people on the defensive because they'll be like, what are you talking about? It's not you the problem. I don't have the problem, you know?
Right.
And then, so I try not to... I just sort of leave people be because I feel like, well, I hope they, you know, if they ask me, I'll be honest about it. But right. I don't want to.
Well, I think it also depends upon the like kind of depth of your like relationship. Like, you know, we were friendly. We're never really friends or anything like that. But I always liked you. And I, you know, I think you remember I was trying to get you on the, you know, work into the radio show.
Oh,
and
yeah,
like
that's
whatever.
Right. We almost
I think we had meetings at your apartment trying to figure it out.
Well, your one of your producers, Josh, right?
Josh Weintraub. Yeah.
Josh reminded me that we almost did a radio show together at Y107.
That's right.
And I completely had forgotten that, and we were like really an inch away from doing this radio show. And I think ultimately what happened was, I think, you know, you just sort of, it was hard for you to leave, you didn't want to leave K-Rock.
Yeah.
And which was a smart thing to do because...
Well, it wasn't even that. It was, I felt too guilty to go against Kevin and Bean. I talked to both of them and to Kevin Weatherly, the program director, and I just couldn't do it. I just felt like I can't do this. And it turned out to be a very good thing that I didn't, because about 2 months later, I got Win Ben Stein's money and, you know, wound up eventually. No, the Man Show, actually, I got the Man Show and wound up leaving radio altogether.
Well, it was easy. It was an easy decision for me because I was, you know, I was making like, I think, $75 a shift or something at K-Rock. And so it just wasn't, only working like three nights a week, it just wasn't enough money. And then I actually, you know, get this really great offer to go do morning radio.
Plus, you hadn't been in the trenches with those guys. I mean, when I got to that radio station, I think we were ranked like 22nd or something
in
the market. Yeah. And, you know, we worked hard and kind of built this show. And then I just felt weird about, even though they offered me a lot more money to go to the other rate, I was just like, I just can't do this. I just don't feel right about it.
Yeah, well, it was good that you did. I mean, the show that I ended up doing with Cortland Cox, who was great, really, really sweet guy. You know, that was when anyone tried to come in and take on K Rock, it was not a good.
Yeah, it was not tough. A good thing. Yeah, they didn't make it easy at K Rock either.
No, especially because radio, it just takes a long time to build up a radio audience. And they're never given enough time before, like, a Spanish station group swoops in and takes over. And that's what ended up happening. It became like, Super Estrella, Grupo de Siete, you know. So
These stations that we don't even know exist are hugely popular.
Like, the most popular stations in town by orders of magnitude.
It's true. And all we know about them are the crazy billboards that, you know, men that look like the devil upside down on a billboard.
What do they do? I don't know. I think there's tubas or something.
You don't even know that it's an advertisement for a radio show. It could be some weird horror movie or something.
Well, when you're... Now that you've been doing everything that you've been doing... I was watching some of the clips from the show, and you really do get these kind of like pantheons of people together in one room. Like, it's pretty amazing. Like, oh, there's... I mean, not that I'm like a Lindsay Lohan fan or whatever, but to see like, oh, you got Lindsay Lohan and Jessica Biel and Jessica Alba and like nine other really famous women in the same room for a sketch. You know, it's kind of super frenzy.
Yeah, that's what I like about it. Is like you get to see, and I like to reveal them one at a time so you can kind of see. But the original idea I had for that was I wanted to have all Jessicas and all Jennifers. So it'd be, you know, Jessica Biel and Jessica Alba and Jessica Simpson. And I wanted to separate it by name, because Jessica and Jennifer, they seem to comprise about 63% of the most beautiful women in Hollywood are named one of those two names. And then I wanted to do, I forget what the last one I would do is, like, oh, like the Beyoncés or something. And there was only one Beyoncé. I don't know, whatever the stupid idea was. But we couldn't get enough of each name together. So we decided to mix it up and put them all in one exercise. Well, three exercise videos.
Are you, how involved day to day are you in the writing process?
Extremely. I mean,
can you let control go, or do you have to have your hands on everything?
I have to. I mean, in the morning I get all the material from the writers. I go through it myself. I whittle like 35 pages down to two or three pages. And then the writers will write the scripts. I'll edit all the scripts. We'll shoot the bits. I'll help edit the bits. I approve the bits sometimes 5 seconds before the show starts. I rewrite the monologue from 4 to 6 p.m., just at my desk, and then send it to the teleprompter, and then we go.
And then by about 9 p.m., you're brain dead.
Yeah, no, actually, I
feel okay.
Yeah, I feel all right. I really don't. I don't have that thing. I don't know what it is. I just, you know, I just kind of, it's just part of my day. And
you don't seem like a stress case. Like, you seem like a pretty, like, well, you know, we'll just get through this, and everything's pretty easy going.
Yeah, I mean, you can't help. I mean, if I was, I'd be dead by now. I mean, you just can't help it. When you're doing the show every night, it's like, it doesn't matter what's going on in your life. I mean, you could have a huge fight with someone, you could, you know, have someone in your family's very sick, or, you know, you're sick yourself, or whatever's going on. It doesn't matter. You have to go down and do the show. And it's weird almost. It's like, it is a little bit robotic that I can put all of those things out of my head.
I guess you learn to compartmentalize that you can still be like, you know, you and Sarah together for a long time. You broke up. You still had to go do the show. Like, you're a guy going through a breakup, but you still every night have to be like, going on the show tonight, we're going to look at Cougar Cubs, you know, and you still have to be excited about it.
It's true, and it's weird. It is weird. But I would imagine that there are probably more extreme, like, you know, like the president has to do this sort of thing. And even like newscasters, like, you know, when you see what these guys are doing, you see Larry King's wearing jeans behind, you know, and he's interviewing the prime minister of Israel or something. And you're like, well, that's weird. And then you realize, oh, yeah, because they're just guys and doing their job and then going home.
You had one of my favorite jokes with, I think you, something you said to Sarah once, where you go, hey, guess where I'm going to fuck you later? I'll give you a hint.
Where did that... That couldn't have been on TV.
It was definitely not on television. It was just... I don't know.
It's funny you remember that, but...
It was just like at the improv or something.
Just to, for Sarah, I would say that was purely a joke. That, yeah. It did not actually happen.
I don't think anyone has ever gotten to have anal sex with someone by going, here's where I'm going.
I mean, you're probably right.
Kirstie Alley's book.
Maybe in prison. But yeah, no, not in the outside world.
That just becomes like the butt mating call. Just like when you hear that, like, oh shit, my ass is going to get fucked. What do I do? I can't stop it from happening.
Well, you know, if you can't stop it, what are you going to do?
I think you just have to go with it.
Yeah, like, or Shawshank.
You give a copy of Kirstie Alley's
book.
Yeah,
we have a copy of Kirstie Alley's book here. I just got it. It's called The Art of Men. I haven't read it yet. I wish I could give you a synopsis, but one of the chapters is... there's a lot of stuff about the ass, but one of the chapters is anal sex. There's, I don't know why I'm promoting this, but it looks terrific. I'm going to read that soon.
Was she on the show?
She will be on the show this week or next week. So, I don't know, soon.
In the podcast format, I feel like we have the luxury of, like, we can talk for an hour, and it's like, you can let the conversation unfold. You know, when you're doing your show, I always think it's a rough format because you have like quick, digestible, bite-sized segments.
Well, you have no time to meander. It's, you know, and there kind of has to be a beginning and an end.
Yeah.
You know, and because the worst case scenario is when somebody's in the middle of an anecdote and I look at the clock and I see that we are over time and we're nowhere near the end of the story. And usually what I will do in that situation is wait until they're finished and then ask them another question.
Follow-up question in three parts.
Just because I like to torment myself. But, you know, and then it screws everyone up after the show. They have to edit the show and it's a pain in the ass. But it is weird. It's like some sort of speed dating, you know, that you just sit down and have a timed conversation with a person who's probably a stranger in most cases, and they have to kind of instantly be interesting. But, you know, I try to keep it fairly loose, and, you know, the better the guest, the looser it can be. And, you know, sometimes you go on a talk show and you feel like you're doing a play.
Right.
You know, it's like you're going to say this, you're going to say this, and it's, I think that's, if somebody's really good at doing that, it can work well, but most of the time it doesn't.
Well, it's hard because you have to... I'm sure there are things that you are genuinely interested in talking about, but you're like, well, the publicist is here. They're here to promote a movie. I have to ask about the movie. We have to show a clip of the movie. Maybe I have time for one random question to sort of, you know, keep it fun.
Yes.
But it seems very restrictive.
It is. But there's, you know, random things do happen, and usually it happens right at the beginning of the segment. Something... It happens on the way in, or they're dressed weird or something strange or whatever, and that's when you can kind of get into something. Then you realize all the work the segment producer did on this interview is right out the window.
Well, I remember the first time I did the show with Furman, Steve Carell was a guest.
Oh,
and
yes.
I thought it was a bit you guys were doing. He started sweating so hard that it looked like he had like a tube under a wig that was just dumping water down the front of his face, and you even comment, you're like, are you okay?
It was like broadcast news. I realized, like, I was going to ignore it because I figured people can't see this at home, but then I realized they can see this at home. It was a weird thing.
Cascading down his face.
Because I love Steve Carell, and at that time he wasn't, you know, this Steve Carell.
No, not quite yet.
But he'd been on the Daily Show so much, but I don't know, something about the talk show format, I think, or maybe it was just hot. I don't know what it was, but he sweated more than anyone I think has ever... Well, sweated on
I think
the show.
There are some guys that, you know, like if they have more of a sketch background or improv background, they will do any character and they'll commit to it 110%. But then when you sit down and look them in the eye and you're like, so what do you like as a person? They're like, I don't.
Maybe he was doing the sweaty character.
Maybe it was a good. And that's how committed he is. That it was literally pouring down the front of his face.
It worked. Whatever it was, it worked.
Robert Pattinson was pretty nice on the show last night.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
I feel bad. I know it sounds crazy. Like, I feel bad for that attractive millionaire. But
well, he does a funny thing where he lies all the time. He'll make lies up in interviews, and then they get reported as fact, and he just kind of doesn't care, and, like, he will tell you, like, he's living under an archway or some weird thing, and then sell it as if he's totally serious about it. I don't know if he does it to entertain himself or what, but it's just so kind weird. Of a funny thing, and it makes it a little bit tricky to do an interview with him because I don't want to seem like a rube, you right. know, but my job there is to accept answers as true.
So, you can't just go, I know that's not true.
Yeah.
None of that's true.
No, you can't.
That's not true.
And
either.
Even that, some of the stuff is so mundane, you wouldn't even, you know, you wouldn't challenge it. But he does, he makes stuff up, which is, it's kind of funny, but he does.
And it was really, it's like there was a ton of security here last night.
Yeah.
And then Kristen Stewart showed up, and then, like, the security got even tighter. And it was just,
yeah.
And I'm just trying to think about their lives. Like, they're just two young people. And they have to live this really weird, isolated lifestyle.
Yeah, they hung out at the show for like 2 hours after. They hung out because they couldn't move.
Outside, there were so many people outside just crowding the exit.
You know, the best thing is you saw how many people were outside last night, right?
Yeah.
I walked out to my car. Not one of them said anything to me. I was like, I had my head down. I was like, I don't want to get caught in this crowd. Not one person yelled at my name.
Hey, Jimmy,
crazy.
What? Is Robert Pattinson coming out? Oh, really? How do you, when you do have someone on the show and it's like you're on the show, it's crunch time, the show's happening, and they're just not giving you anything, what's your trick? Do you have it? What's your bag?
I will do the interview myself is usually what will happen. I'll start telling them about things from my life and just kind of... In fact, it's funny because sometimes people have fan groups that are excited that so-and-so is going to be on the show, and you know that this person is not a great interview. And so I will kind of... I'll talk more than I typically will. And usually what happens is their fans get mad. Like, you talked through the whole interview.
Yes.
We didn't get to hear... But I've had, you know, guests on the show that go, I don't do anecdotes. That kind of stuff. I'm like, all right, well, what are we going
to
have?
I don't like to talk. I don't want to talk about the movie. I don't do anecdotes. Don't look me in the eye.
They always want to talk about the movie. The movie they almost always want to talk about.
I've gotten that sometimes, too, where people complain about the podcast. They go, you know, you just talk. You didn't even get to hear him talk. And what you can't explain to people is, like, when you're looking someone in the eye, if you have any level of experience at your job, you have an automatic sense of when they're going to finish talking and how much they want to talk about. Because you can see their face.
Right.
And you know, like, this is about to end. This is going to end in 2 seconds. And there's going to be a wall at the end. And they're not going to give me a thing to jump off of. It's just going to be a... And then that's when we flew on the plane.
Yeah. It happens a lot, unfortunately. And it really makes you appreciate the guests that come with stuff to talk about.
Oh, I imagine it must. Yeah. It must feel...
Like when Letterman was on my show in Brooklyn, he was very serious about preparing for the interview, which you might not expect. But he, you know, what he said to our segment producer is, when Jimmy's on my show, he always has a lot of things to talk about. And he's got, you know, a lot of anecdotes and jokes or whatever. And so I want to have the same thing when I'm on his show. And it's funny because I kind of learned that from him, from reading interviews with him talking about how prepared Steve Martin is whenever he's on the show. And I remember making a mental note going, like, if I'm ever on the show, I'm going to be very prepared and Dave will be happy and then Dave will like me and invite me back. And it's just weird to think about Dave sitting there thinking, what am I going to talk about on, you know, on the Kimmel show?
I'm just glad that he still cares, you know? Like, it's nice to hear that he still cares and not like, fuck it, who cares?
I always care. I think probably the healthiest people are the ones who don't care anymore, who just go, we'll just wing it, you know?
It'll be fine.
Yeah, because, I mean, for me, I obsess about these things, you know? When I go on a show... you know, I know what it's like to be the host and the guest doesn't really have anything to talk about. And I also know what it's like to go on a show and get asked the same 6 questions over and over again. And it's just like, you feel like I could tell, you know, you, not you, but the host, I could tell you the answer, but I know that people who follow me have heard me answer this question 12 times and I don't want to make them sit through this. You
right.
Know?
Well, all the stuff that went down with Leno was amazing, and I know that's a thing that you've talked about a million times, but it really was like, holy shit. And I think it's one of the things that I don't when I put myself in the position that you were in, I don't think I would have had the mettle to follow through with it. I would have been like, oh, I can't do this. I can't do this.
I just felt like I had to. I really did. I mean, I felt like I'd be letting everyone down if I didn't. And it would have been easier, and it was very uncomfortable, and it was really not, you know, not something that I was looking forward to at all. But I just felt like it's just, it was, would have been so dishonest to sit there and not talk about, you know, this again was in the heat of the, you know, the Jay Conan battle that was going on, and for me to go on that show and to just give it a, you know, a brief mention would have been, I don't know, I just, if I was watching me, I would have went, oh, that guy's a dick.
But at the same time, I mean, listen, I don't know, I really don't know the behind the scenes of what really happened. I mean, I think I've been pretty public about that I was a Team Conan on that side of, mm-hmm. Of the equation, but you know, it is just interesting that there have been two major late night wars in television, and he was won them both. In both of them.
Yeah, I know. He instigated them both.
Yeah, like it almost.
He's the Iran of late night talk show hosts.
Why is everyone so mad? Like you know, he sort of plays. I mean, I don't know him, but I've never met him. I don't know him. He might be the loveliest guy in the
world.
He's
a very friendly guy. I mean, you know, whatever. But I mean, listen, this is like he says Conan was his friend. He says Letterman is a friend. There are things you don't do to your friends, and those are two of them. If these people are your friends, then that was not a right thing to do.
But you know, he definitely. I do understand. It is something that I look at and I go, I wonder if I'm going to be that way in, like, you know, 20 years, where I need to constantly be in motion. I need to be working because it defines who I am. And if I stop for a second, then I'm going to fucking blow my brains out.
Yeah, except for, though, I mean, you're still able to do stand. I don't know. To me, it would have been a beautiful, graceful exit for Jay Leno, who, you know, what I don't know. But that, I'm not him. I don't know what goes through his head. Maybe he just loves doing the show so much that he couldn't bear to leave it, even though he agreed to leave it in 5 years and he went through that whole crazy thing. But I don't know. He's still got stand-up comedy. I'm sure if he wanted to do a show, people would find a way to give him a show immediately.
I guess that's true. But I just... Do you feel like you... Is there a point where you go, yeah, you know, after doing the show for a while, I'd be fine to just relax and not have to work anymore?
Yeah, I could do that at the end of the month, no problem. Give me time to pack and say goodbye to everyone.
I go fucking crazy if I I stop, like when I take a vacation, I cannot.
Well, I do something else though. I mean, you know, for me, it doesn't have to be something big either. It's like, I really like drawing and making T-shirts. And I love cooking. And, you know, just for me, these are just like, it really just, I get satisfaction out of people enjoying this stuff. So if I'll draw something, I'll then show it to everyone. Like, isn't this, you know, funny? If I get the reaction I like, I'm happy. And then I'll go draw something else. Or if I cook something and people like the way it tasted, then I'm happy and I'll cook something else.
Yeah.
And it's just really the same. I mean, it's just all, it's the same dynamic for me.
So the success part of it and the fame part and the money part, did that, were you able to handle that pretty well in stride? Or does
I think so. I mean, I think so. I just, I had a very gradual ascent, really. I mean, it was, you know, from starting radio, where people know who you are only if you want them to know who you are, to, you know, cable television, where I get recognized maybe once a week from Win Ben Stein's Money, and then just very kind of, it was a gradual thing for me. So maybe if I was hit with it all at once, I wouldn't have handled it well. I think I probably would have handled it okay.
Like 15 years before you even really made it to television, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've been on TV for almost 20 years.
But even before that, there was like...
And then there was radio before that, yeah.
God, that's amazing. I think it is sort of... I'm glad that when I worked at MTV that it didn't blow up to something bigger right then, because I don't think I could have... I really don't think I could have handled it.
It was pretty big, though. I mean, that show was... Huge.
It was, but what happened right after it wasn't huge, and I didn't know what to do with it.
Right.
I wasn't touring as a stand-up at the time. I didn't know.
You didn't know how to turn it into money.
No idea what to do with it. I just thought, oh, well, I'll just get another show. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, that's actually really hard.
Yeah.
They don't just hand those out. And I think, you know, again, just kind of tying it all back together and not to be too gushy on you about it, but it really was, after I got reflective and sort of straightened my life and I looked at guys like you and Rob and just said, oh, yeah, that's right. You actually, if you want a thing, you have to just go out and make it. Like, no one's just going to fucking go, hey, here's your thing you always wanted. You know, don't worry, you don't have to do anything for it.
I mean, that does happen every once in a while.
Very
but
rarely. If you're Ashton Kutcher, it happens. That really happened to him. It's like, he was a model, and then he got on That 70 Show, and that was it.
Yeah, yeah. But at least he still had to sit there and audition with, like, 30 other guys, and then they picked him, and he must have done okay, but... It is. I mean, that's the deal. Is you have to be responsible for yourself.
Yeah. Well, this has been great. We're just at about an hour, and I'm so glad. I don't know if you remember, but I asked you to come on the podcast like right after we started, and you're like, I don't have time. You know, you're like, I can't do it.
Well, you know what? The truth is, it just becomes a nightmare for me.
I understand.
Because I know a lot of guys who have podcasts.
Yes.
And now that I've been on with you,
yes.
Please don't email me. I'm not doing your podcast.
I just have to tell you, like, honestly, on a personal level, when I saw the email, I was hurt by it because I was like, oh, shit. And then I had to remember, like, it's like what you said before, like, well, Jimmy, it's not like Jimmy and I are good friends. We just know each other.
Oh, you were. It's interesting because from my point of view, I felt like I had these people who I've known for longer than you that have these podcasts,
yes,
who just wouldn't understand. And then I would have to go and explain to all of them.
Yes.
Even though I know that your podcast is going to be better than all of their podcasts, it becomes like, I have a lot of guilt I have to deal with. I have a lot of anxiety.
Well, yeah, of course, especially, you know, Italian background, right?
Yeah.
So I have the same background. My mother, Italian, Catholic background.
Yeah.
It is an economy of guilt. You feel bad about everything, and you want to empathize. You don't really have a choice. You automatically take on the emotional state of anyone that's near you.
That's true.
And it's very hard to process, and so you get resentful sometimes. I'm telling you in retrospect that I understand, and that at the time I was like, oh, my feelings are a bit restful. Like, well, of course. Because you start to get resentful when people ask you for stuff because you're like, shit, because I'm going to have to say no, and then I'm going to feel bad, and then they're going to feel bad, and there's nothing I can do about it.
It really is. I wish I didn't have email because it's I get asked for the craziest things. I mean, I get asked, this is the craziest thing. People will be like, people in my life like, hey, who do you have on the show in November? Like, really? You can't... Could you maybe ask somebody else or look in the newspaper or something? I mean, seriously. Do you have any idea how busy I am?
Hey, how come they ran those Taco Bell spots during your show? I don't know.
I had a guy who was driving me in New York who sent me a text saying, hey, can I get the main number to the hotel that you're staying at?
What?
I'm like, I don't know. We have something called information. It's the Marriott. It's not like you don't know the name of the hotel. What goes on? And then I feel bad about not giving him that information.
Of course.
I have to struggle with it and look at it and go, am I going to look this up now and text it to him? Or am I going to let him do it for himself?
Well, because the problem is, because I'm sure people listen like, well, what's the problem? You just send the fucking number. And then you go, yeah, but then you're establishing a precedent. And then you're going to get 5 more texts from that guy asking you to do stuff for him.
And not only that, he can find the number. It's just the same way I found the number.
It would have been just as easy.
Oh, it's crazy.
But I'm thrilled that you came on now because...
I am happy to make this my final podcast ever.
This is your podcast farewell tour. This is it.
This is it. This was the one.
I'm so excited that you will never...
Sorry, Adam.
That you'll never do another podcast again.
This was the one.
This was the one.
Well, I'm glad it was this one, and
thanks,
I enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, you too. It's good to
Hardwick
see you.
Works with no notes. There's no list of questions.
No.
It's all off the top of his head.
I don't, yeah.
I give you, what, like 3 hours notice for this?
It was short
yes.
notice.
Well, you did great.
Well, thanks, man. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Enjoy your burritos, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she is willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Rhea Seehorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.